from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum this morning, what if the government guaranteed an income to all people, regardless of their financial means? Known as a universal basic income, the concept is gaining followers on the political left and right who see it as a tool to reduce income inequality and prepare workers for a future where many jobs will be automated. Critics argue that it would be prohibitively expensive. Pilot programs, including one in Oakland, are exploring the effects of a guaranteed income at the local level. And yesterday, in a historic referendum, Swiss voters voted against adopting a universal national income. In the Forum Hour ahead, we'll discuss the pros and cons of a guaranteed basic income. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Yesterday, Swiss voters rejected a referendum that would have guaranteed a government-funded basic income for the nation's citizens. Last week, a pilot program was launched in Oakland to give a basic income around $1,000 to $2,000 a month to 100 local families, or actually between 50 and 100. And supporters of basic income claim that it would fix the broken safety net, reduce poverty, and offset widespread layoffs due to technological change. But opponents argue that it would be prohibitively expensive and that implementing it would be unrealistic. And in this Forum Hour, we take up the topic of the growing universal basic income movement. We have a whole panel assembled, but before we introduce the members of the panel, a couple of them here in studio with me, I want to introduce Scott Santons, who is a writer and advocate for basic income. And again, it's a movement to provide every person a guaranteed basic income. He himself subsists on a basic income provided through crowdfunding, and he's with us from Basel, Switzerland. And welcome, Scott Santons.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, glad to have you. First thing I want to ask you is, disappointed? It was about 76%, I think, in Switzerland that voted against this, what would have been about $2,560 a month for every citizen. Does that set back the movement in your mind, or how does it have an impact on you?
Not at all. This is a big step forward for us. You can look at it as it was, quote, soundly defeated, but at the same time, we're talking over 500,000 people just voted yes to give everybody in Switzerland a basic income. And that's a big deal. It's a big deal, too, that people all over the world now are talking about this. We've never seen this kind of coverage anywhere in the week leading up to it. And now, like, everybody's talking about this idea. And the thing is this idea is actually still unknown to so many people. So just the fact that millions of people right now are learning about basic income, just the concept of it for the very first time, just right now, it's huge.
Well, many of our listeners are hearing about it for the first time, so let's talk about what it is from your perspective. I mean, why have a universal guaranteed income? There are many who would say it's just going to make people lazier and deflate the work ethic and be a disincentive for work. There are many who do say that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the thing is, it's actually it's a incentive to work. It's a misunderstanding of how the current welfare works that we see this as a disincentive. See, the way the current welfare works right now is by targeting it to people for not working. We're essentially paying people not to work, and then we punish them for working by removing their benefits. Effectively, we end up taxing them like 80% and above. So we all know that if you tax somebody that high, you're going to create a work disincentive. So why do we think that's okay? And with a basic income, that changes that. With a basic income, you earn your income floor, and then anything you earn above that, you keep. There's no loss of your income. Essentially, it's in your best interest to work and to earn that income because you get to keep it.
So everyone gets the benefit of essentially, I mean, it's in some ways, I guess, Social Security and the way payments are made there is kind of a model here or a paradigm?
Yeah, in the U.S., the best way to understand it is kind of a Social Security for all. It's just instead of like varying amounts, it would just be the same amount. Essentially, about $1,000 per month in the U.S. is a common figure because our poverty guidelines are essentially set at $11,880 per year living in poverty. So giving people $12,000 a year per individual would essentially eliminate poverty.
You'd have about $10,000 to 300 million Americans, which would be roughly over $3 trillion a year. And where's that money going to come from?
Right. So if you look at just the napkin math of saying, okay, it'll count up to $3 trillion, the thing is that we actually can eliminate and should eliminate a bunch of what we already spend. So you're looking at the current welfare programs, and you're even looking at a lot of subsidies and loopholes. And you know, there's so many things that we can change in both the tax code and over 200 programs that we run that we can actually reduce that amount. And we basically essentially need to raise about additional $1.5 trillion in the U.S. And that may sound big, too, but at the same time, there are a lot of ways to do that. We could do a 10% value-added tax, would be about $750 billion or so. We could do a carbon tax, which would get us quite a bit of the way there, depending on how big a carbon tax that is. We could do financial transaction taxes. We could do land value taxes.
Well,
there's a lot of ways of going about this.
You were cheered by the number of people who went out and voted for this in Switzerland. Why do you think it was so, in some ways, disproportionately defeated?
Well, I like to put this in a context of another referendum here in Switzerland that happened in 1959. And there, too, a referendum was defeated. And it was defeated by two-thirds of the population, so kind of similar. And the thing is that was considered kind of a crazy idea. 12 years later, it went to referendum again, and they passed it. The thing is that idea was to give women the right to vote. So if you think about this that way, like, there are certain ideas that we look back to the past as being crazy that we just didn't have before. And this is like one of those ideas. It's a step forward. And everyone here, they did a survey of everyone in Switzerland, and they found that about 7 out of 10 of all Swiss voters believe that there will be a second referendum on this in the future. And I think that's also related to the fact that, again, 7 out of 10 voters feel that in the years ahead, there's going to be a lot of changes in the way that we work. There's not going to be the old style of working, not the same like careers and jobs. There's a big changes ahead. So we fully expect that.
Scott Santens, again, is with us from Basel, Switzerland. He's a writer and advocate for basic income. And Scott Santens, appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And let me tell you who we have for the rest of the hour here. Natalie Foster's here in studio. She's a fellow at the Institute for the Future. They're a nonprofit research center based in Palo Alto that focuses on long-term forecasting. And she's also a co-founder of Peers, which is an organization that supports workers in the sharing economy. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also, glad to have Matthew Krisiloff here in studio. He manages the Basic Income Project that I alluded to earlier in Oakland called Y Combinator. Welcome to you.
Hi, thanks.
And Mike Tanner is with us from the nation's capital. He's a senior fellow with the Cato Institute. He heads research on poverty, social welfare, and healthcare policy. Mike Tanner, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
Glad to have all of you. And Natalie Foster, let me begin with you. This is a movement which is growing. Is there really enough people, you think, that you can get on board here? And is there the political will?
Well, I think we're in the very early days. I think Scott's right. People are just starting to talk about this idea, and it's because of votes like what happened in Switzerland that people are talking about it. And just to underscore his point, in December there was a poll done in Switzerland with about 11% support, and on voting day we saw about 23% support. So in the course of a few months, as the conversation heated up, support for the idea doubled, which I think is important when looking at the U.S. I think we're several years behind Europe in terms of this conversation and just really getting started.
So this is essentially, and we're going to talk about the Oakland pilot project, but as you see it, maybe a slow start, but you see it growing, you see it burgeoning.
Well, I think it's early, but it is definitely growing. If you look at the numbers on Reddit, if you look at the Google search graphs, it's a hockey stick graph going straight up with people searching, what is this universal basic income? What does it mean? I mean, it has now been editorialized against in the New York Times, which is, you know, means that there's actually something to discuss. But on the ground, we actually have people who are holding meetups and create-a-thons around this idea all over the country. We held a create-a-thon here in San Francisco that filled up in about 20 hours with people who spent all weekend building projects, video projects, websites, different things that tell the story and support the idea. So there's a lot of support both in the Valley and across the country.
You mentioned the New York Times editorial. I think the pith of that or the substance of that had a lot to do with whether or not this is the best way to eliminate poverty, because that's the argument that many of you who are advocates put forward. And they talk about about other ideas that seem, frankly, from their perspective, the editorial perspective, more optimal, like job guarantees or infrastructure, subsidized employment and so forth. Why a guaranteed income as opposed to those other ideas?
Well, I actually think all of these ideas are worth exploring. I mean, we're at a moment in this movement where we're talking about giving money to people. And I think that's what is important here. I like, you know, when people have money, there's a certain freedom and agency that goes with that to be able to, you know, decide to take care of your children or to, you know, walk off a job that you didn't want to stay at or, you know, start something new. And I think that's the piece that is really inspiring.
Or just live off the money itself.
And play a violin, sure.
Right. Again, Natalie Foster is a fellow of the Institute for the Future. And Matthew Krisiloff is also with us this morning. He manages the Basic Income Project with Y Combinator in Oakland. And it's a short-term project, which would presumably lead to a longer study or a longer project. When?
That's
what's
correct.
The timeline?
That's the hope. So the plan is we would run a pilot for about 6 months to a year in Oakland. And then if that is promising, we would lead on with a full 5-year study that could possibly be extended to. We don't exactly know what that would look like yet.
And you're, we should say that Y Combinator is a tech incubator, basically.
Correct. Y Combinator started about 10 years ago, and primarily what it does is fund technology startups, and it's been very, very successful over time. Airbnb, Dropbox, Reddit, these are companies that just started with two founders and are now multi-billion dollar companies.
Well, are you trying to make money off this then? I mean, why are you doing this?
Definitely not. So the Basic Income Project is running as part of YC Research, which we think of as a group to really develop the types of projects we think could be most important for the world leading forward. So this is the second of three projects that we've publicly announced.
Philanthropy.
Philanthropy, essentially.
And why Oakland?
We thought it would be best to do this closer to home rather than somewhere far abroad. Just because a study like this is so expensive, especially in the pilot phase, it makes sense to concentrate resources in a specific area to start to figure out logistics and then grow out from there. So it's possible the fuller study could include other areas as well.
But there's a link to the tech economy in all this. I mean, in the sense that the tech economy is changing things, and people are losing jobs hand and foot.
There is. That wasn't the primary consideration for choosing Oakland, though. It just seemed like doing it closer to home made a lot of sense.
And the source of the money and what kind of amount of money are we talking about to float this pilot project?
Sure. So we're putting it up ourselves for this pilot, and we're going to be giving about $2,000 a month to individuals, about 50 to 100 people, for the duration of the pilot.
This is basic needs we're talking about, or even though the cost of housing in Oakland, like everywhere else, just continues to rise.
It is, and we could adjust it a bit up if we feel like it's not sufficient to meet those basic needs, but we really see what we're creating as a floor rather than something that people will permanently live on. I mean, certainly they're able to do whatever they want. They could not work, they could work, they could volunteer, but we just see it as a floor to get started.
So the emphasis is on the freedom this provides to people and to a great deal, isn't it?
It's a really interesting aspect we want to learn about for sure. We definitely see this as potentially enabling freedom. We don't know exactly what that looks like, though.
Matthew Krisiloff manages the Basic Income Project with Y Combinator, and Mike Tanner is with us, as I said, from the nation's capital. He's a senior fellow with Cato Institute, where he heads research on poverty, social welfare, and healthcare policy. It's safe to say, Mike Tanner, even if this would go into operation or be functioning on some level, that it's certainly not going to necessarily do away with poverty as we know it.
Well, we would hope that it would help in the long run. There's a strong theoretical case for a universal basic income. The problem is that we're letting the idea get a little bit ahead of what we know on it. The actual practicalities of the implementation are a big problem and haven't been thought through all the way. Just the cost alone, for example, if you were to give every American a basic income of, say, $10,000, you're talking between $3 and $4 trillion, which is, you know, slightly larger than our entire federal budget today, and it's 2 to 3 times as much as we're spending on poverty programs right now. You simply couldn't afford to finance that. If, on the other hand, you try to make it more means-tested to bring down the cost, you recreate some of the incentive problems for work that we have now. If you look back at things that tested the negative income tax back in the 70s with the Manpower Resource Demonstration Project, they found that this did have an impact on whether or not people were willing to work.
And what do you think or what do you expect would be the overall impact on the economy if this were to go in operation?
Well, it all depends on how you were designed. If it replaced the existing welfare system, which we know does not work very well, and you were able to hold the cost down to about what we're spending now, I think it would be a net benefit. But if it was something that was significantly more expensive and required a huge increase in taxes in order to pay for it, I think that's going to slow economic growth, and you're simply not going to have the money you need to redistribute. You have to have wealth before you can redistribute it.
Wouldn't there also be problems with implementation and not only difficulties with the cost and incentives, as you've outlined it, but just basic implementation of this?
Well, again, it depends on the design. That is most simple, simply sending everybody in America a check for, say, $10,000, that's pretty transparent. It's pretty simple. It's efficient. That's why people like Milton Friedman, for example, have supported this type of approach, or Charles Murray from the American Enterprise Institute. On the other hand, if you try to make it more targeted, you then get into all the complexities that go with the tax code. What is wealth? What are assets? What constitutes work? You begin to end up with all sorts of bureaucracy built up around it.
Are we also maybe separating assistance from need?
Well, I mean, in a sense that if it went to everybody, you would be, which in some ways is good. I mean, it deals with some of the stigma that attaches to welfare programs. It deals with a lot of the paternalism that goes with the current program, where we treat people who receive assistance like they're three-year-olds and parcel out their allowance a little bit for food, a little bit for health care, a little bit for housing, rather than letting them take responsibility for their own lives and having to budget and behave like everyone else. On the other hand, if you go to everybody, you're simply going to be tossing money at the problem without any regard for the cost of it.
What about some of these concerns that you hear Mike Tanner raising here, Natalie Foster? Can you address them?
Yeah, well, look, I think that for the past 40 years, we've seen the economic growth and production go up, 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 and wages to American households go down, down, down.
They haven't risen in 40 years.
They haven't risen in 40 years. I believe there is plenty of money. The money is not the problem. It's the political will to do something about it. Let's look at the country of Alaska, or the state of Alaska, where I think we have a version of this actually on the books. Several decades ago, a Republican governor created a sovereign wealth fund, and when the oil companies came in to drill for oil, taxed the companies and put that into the fund. And so every year, residents of Alaska are debited between $1,000 and $3,000 directly into their account, and that's supplemental income that they don't have to work for. So Alaskans continue to do what they do and do their work, but they know this money comes in. And that's the kind of thing I think you could create around the country. It looks a lot like Social Security in that way, which, again, was a very radical idea prior to its implementation. It started quite small in the United States, and it's gone up, up, up because it's actually working. It's solving poverty among the elderly. And so I think there's many ways one could go about this. It's the early days of this conversation. And I think before we start to, you know, move on policy, it's actually important to be doing research projects and actually have pilots going, which is why I think what Y Combinator is doing is important. But also, GiveDirectly, another nonprofit, has announced a $30 million study in Kenya and Uganda. And there are several cities around the world who are looking at pilots, both Utrecht and Lausanne in Switzerland. And the Canadian government has recently announced they'll be figuring something out in Canada. So I think over the next few years, we're going to have a lot more data than we currently have.
But we do have some data, and there has been some research. Matthew Krislov, let me ask you to address this. There was research on vets with guaranteed income, and it showed a decline in the workforce. I'm sure you're familiar with this research, decline in workforce participation when the program was expanded to new groups of veterans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think going forward, there's that research, and there was also research done in the 1970s around negative income tax, which was Milton Friedman's specific implementation of basic income. And in both of those, it did show work did decline some amount. I think nowadays, if that is to be the case, and it's not exactly clear if that would be the case, it would be a little bit more acceptable. We're talking about certain groups, for example, that might be working two or three jobs to make end meet, which is just a condition most of us don't necessarily have to participate in. I also think, and this is a huge reason I think why Combinator is approaching this, is we are on the cusp of much greater abundance in the world driven by technology. It's something that is kind of hard to think about right now, but there really are advances in, I think, artificial intelligence specifically that will allow us to have a tremendous higher number of resources than we have right now. It's hard to see how these little two-person startups might develop with new technology, as we've seen with Airbnb over a 10-year trajectory into a $35 billion company that touches everywhere in the world. But we're starting to see this at Y Combinator with much more fundamental transformative technologies.
Well, in fact, there's been speculation that we may be losing the majority of Uber drivers in 5 to 7 years, and so those kind of factors really play into this, I understand. But let me go back to you, Mike Tanner, if I could. There's also, couldn't this have potential to undercut social service systems? So instead of investing in programs, we just give people money, and couldn't that end up providing far less support for the poor?
Well, I think it would be hard to argue that the social safety net we have today is working very well. We're spending about $1 trillion supporting some 120 different social welfare programs, and yet we're having a very minimal impact on poverty and almost no impact at all on economic mobility. So I certainly think that this would offer a better approach in regard to the incentives that are built into the system. But what Natalie describes is exactly the reason why you have to be careful about the implementation. Social Security is some $26 trillion in the red going forward. And the Alaska Permanent Fund is now in trouble because the price of oil has declined, and they don't know how they're going to come up with money from general revenue in order to meet the payments that they promised on this. So you've got to be a little bit careful in terms of these funding sources, that if they don't keep up, you're not going to be able to meet the obligations you're creating. And the taxes necessary to meet those obligations can wipe out the very economic growth you're talking about.
Yeah, let me ask you about this, Natalie Foster, from your perspective.
Well, look, I think that there are a number of ways that we could, capture the wealth that we need to spread to the lower and middle classes to make this work. I think that's why it's important we start experimenting on the local level and at the state level before we move on federal policy.
Couldn't it undercut social service systems? I mean, that's really at the core of what I was asking Mike Tanner. You know, so instead of investing in the programs, you just give people money, and that could end up providing less support for the poor.
Well, I think there's a strong case to be made for keeping the welfare system as it is and then supplementing onto that, particularly as we move into a transition. I mean, nobody believes robots are going to come take our jobs tomorrow, but many of us believe that the future, things will look very different. So between now and then, let's start figuring out how we supplement people's income in addition to thinking about the long term. I mean, McKinsey has a study out right now that says about 45% of tasks humans currently do could be automated with off-the-shelf technology. That means that this is coming sooner than we think.
Well, there is a movement to provide all people a basic income, and it is gaining a following, and I want to hear what you, our listeners, have to say about it or any questions you may have. And you can join us now at our toll-free number. I invite you to do that. The number is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program. Toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or feel free to write comments or questions onto our Facebook page. But do join the program. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. What if the government guaranteed an income to all people, regardless of their financial means, known as universal basic income? The concept is gaining followers on the political left and right, who see it as a tool to reduce income inequality and prepare workers for a future where many jobs will be automated. We're discussing the pros and cons of a guaranteed basic instinct. We spoke earlier with Scott Santens, a writer and advocate for basic income, who was in Basel, Switzerland, where there was just a referendum yesterday that decided somewhat strongly against the basic income prospects for Switzerland. And with us in studio, Natalie Foster, a fellow with the Institute for the Future, and Matthew Krisiloff, who manages the Basic Income Project with Y Combinator, that's a pilot program in Oakland, and Mike Tanner's with us from Washington, senior fellow with the Cato Institute, where he heads research on poverty, social welfare, and healthcare policy. You are welcome to join the program and have your own thoughts and opinions disseminated here, or bring any questions or comments to the fore. Again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'll read a couple of comments here. Robert writes, despite Mr. Satin's flat earth claim to the contrary, the Swiss vote was a resounding rejection for this idea. People are talking about it because they're perplexed as to how it was put on the ballot there. Ben, on the other hand, writes, this coming robot revolution will replace so many workers. If we do not try some new solution now, we will get caught off guard and the wealth gap will be even greater. Let's go to your calls, and let me begin with Sacramento caller Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, first time caller. I love your program. Listen to it all the time. My question is this. To what extent would such a program result have a huge inflationary effect so that you have to keep raising the minimum amount that you are giving to each person versus to what extent would it accelerate the economy so that there would be overall an increase in the value of the goods and services provided that would be real because of the acceleration of the spending, basically. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you for the question, Bill. And Mike Tanner, let me go to you here. There's been certainly a lot of talk about those who have been critical of this movement about inflation and the sort of effect that the caller was bringing about.
Well, it would depend, again, on whether or not you were simply repurposing the money that's in the existing social welfare system, which is what people like Charles Murray and Milton Friedman and others have talked about. If you were doing that and simply spending it on a more efficient basis, I think you would actually have a positive impact on the economy, and it would not be particularly inflationary. If, on the other hand, you were simply trying to pump more money into the economy, it would depend on whether it was debt financed or whether or not it was through taxes. One would lower economic growth. The other would be potentially inflationary.
And here's Vince joining us from Monterey. Vince, you just voted in the Swiss election?
Yeah, I'm a citizen of Switzerland and of the U.S. I voted in Switzerland this past weekend, and I voted for the basic income, not so much in the expectation that it would pass, but we have a long history of influencing social policy even through failed referenda. I think the idea of having the discussion about how to distribute wealth differently at a time when income inequality, globally is in disarray, I think is worthwhile. And there are good models in this country. The Alaska model, imperfect as it is, the negative income tax in New Jersey that was tried in the late 60s as another model. I think it's an interesting way where the left and the right come together and explore new models.
Well, thank you for that, Vince. It was good to hear from you. And it prompts me to ask you, Vince's call prompts me to ask you, if I may, Matthew Krisiloff, what standards are you using in the Oakland Pilot Project for measurement of success?
Sure. So we're going to be, the pilot will focus primarily on figuring out implementation methods, if they will work well or not. So things like data collection, how we'll be selecting participants, along those lines. So I think it'll actually be pretty hard for the pilot to go poorly along those sense for designing a larger study. The only thing that would really deter it, I think, is if it was very clear that people were not doing anything either neutral or positive with their basic incomes. If it was the type of case where people were sitting around doing nothing, playing video games and doing drugs all day long, then we would want to rethink how could this look a little bit differently than how we're thinking about it right now.
And a comment from Peter along the lines you've just outlined. He says, universal health care and tuition-free universities are cheap compared to a universal basic income. If voters won't vote for higher taxes to pay for health care and college education, which are seen as good things, why would they vote for the much higher taxes that would pay everyone to do nothing. Not to mention that unlike the other two programs, universal basic income has no track record of success anywhere because it hasn't been implemented anywhere. You say what to that, Natalie Foster?
Well, first of all, it certainly hasn't been tried yet. And, you know, I think this is the same thing we said when we talked about putting a man on the moon. This is a big idea. We're still ways off in the United States from actual policy discussions. I think it's at the idea phase. And I think that is a good place to be.
Is there I'm looking at another email from a listener named Philip who says there's a UBI implementation in Finland, and what's the impact of that or the details of it? Are you familiar with
it? My understanding is that the country's looking at a pilot. The government has announced it will be doing something.
So it has not been implemented.
Correct. Yeah. The interesting thing is over the last few years, I think due in part to extreme inequality around the world and the understanding of automation and its impacts on the workforce, people are taking this idea much more seriously. They're recognizing that incremental policies won't get us to the place where we want to be, you know, where everyone has a floor from which to start. And so we're starting to see pilots spring up in Canada, like I said, in European cities. And I think next step with Y Combinator's study in the U.S. are several others in the United States as well.
And here's Amkar. Amkar, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, if we implement unconditional basic income by replacing existing welfare schemes, then what happens if somebody decides to spend their income on drugs or gambling or alcohol, and then they don't have any money left for basic necessities? Do we let them starve at that point, or we have a supplemental welfare services, or we rely on private charities? What do we do?
Yeah, Natalie Foster.
My concern is not, you know, people, what people are going to do with the money. I think, you know, there are people who will play video games and drink alcohol just like they do right now. I think one of the things we're seeing with the studies that GiveDirectly has been doing over the last several years is that, in fact, when given capital, people don't stop working. In fact, they work harder. Many people started actual businesses because they had an infusion of capital that they were able to do. Others, like mothers who have taken care of children, you know, for a long time unpaid, are able to do the work that they wanted to do. So I think that's, you know, something certainly worth looking at.
It's also, Mike Tanner, kind of unpredictable how people will, and we need some data here, but what are your thoughts along the lines of that caller Amkar's question, that there may be people who just, you know, blow their wad, whatever it is?
Well, there is very little data in the United States, but on the other hand, what little data we do have suggests that the poor don't spend their money much different than everyone else. If you look, for example, at various states that have tried to implement drug testing for people on welfare, what they find is there's no evidence that people on welfare use drugs at any higher rate than the general population. Most of those projects actually end up wasting more money than they save. In general, the poor spend money like everyone else. Now, I will caution the one thing, and I do think the Natalie's description, the GiveDirectly stuff is right on point, but that is a limited time period, and people may behave differently if that money is guaranteed for their entire life rather than for a year or 5 years. I would just quickly add that I think there's a bit of black and white thinking around what social welfare programs could exist and could not. There's kind of this dichotomy that we either need to get rid of everything and supplement it with or replace it with basic income, or just directly supplement basic income with what we have now. And it could be a combination of programs. I mean, I think there are certainly people out there that are not totally capable of taking care of themselves. There are people that are below the poverty line that may suffer from mental illness, for example, and it can't just be expected that we give them $12,000 and they can just take care of themselves like that. We need to think about the right balance of what programs we have right now that should exist and what it could look like with basic income added onto that as well, and what would be removed.
Well, how do you decide this floor number, for example? I mean, I'm looking at a question from a listener named Elizabeth who says, how do you set the level of monthly dollars per person allocated in each region? What kind of formula is being used? What did you do in Oakland about setting a formula?
Honestly, I don't think there is like an exact way to know what the exact number is depending on region. I think right now with Oakland, it's semi-arbitrary that we're selecting 1,800 to 2,000. It is approximately a poverty line we think would be appropriate for the Oakland area, but it could be wrong and we could change that number. That's part of the reason of doing a pilot and part of the reason about thinking about studies more broadly in the U.S. and beyond of what this could actually look like. We just don't know yet.
And more of your calls. We go next to Dale. Dale, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks. I'm just curious. It seems kind of convoluted in a sense. Well, I don't know why we don't go back to the public sector of just perhaps taxing wealth where it was, you know, 50 years ago, and having a bringing back jobs and education and our infrastructure and the public parks. And there's so much that we could be doing collectively via these public organizations where people are still earning their money. I think when you give money away, it probably has less value attached to it. So maybe it's about creating opportunity and doing that via the traditional, you know, public mode.
Let's hear from you on this, Mike Tanner.
Well, I think the problem is that that many of the people who are not working are not really able to work today. There's a large number of disabled people. There's people without education. There's people with young children at home. I think that to suggest that the reason people are poor is simply because they refuse to take jobs is wrong on both the left and the right. I think that what we really need to talk about is how we can increase mobility and give people the set of skills they need or the set of resources they need in order to climb out of poverty. And frankly, you're poor because you don't have money. Yeah, I mean, that's essentially the definition of poverty.
Yeah, Natalie Foster wanted to say something.
And I think it's a false dichotomy to say we have to choose between public parks and giving people a universal basic income. That's not a world in which I want to live. I absolutely believe we have to continue, you know, to fund the things that make this country wonderful, the national parks, our public parks, and we have enough to be able to give people a floor from which to start. I actually think, you know, our founding fathers hoped that there would be a day where automation would come and give people more time to live their life and time to do democracy, as they said, be on their kids' school board, you know, sit on a neighborhood board. And that has, in fact, not been the case in the United States if you look over the course of the Industrial Revolution and into recent history. And so I think this policy is the kind of idea that would give us back that sense of bring on the automation, bring on the robots, and give us all time to do the things we need to do.
Yeah, actually, apropos what you said about our founding fathers, Donna writes, as far as this being a new idea, I believe Richard Nixon, when he was president, entertained the idea of a guaranteed annual income in the United States. But it was discussed by the founding fathers and Thomas Paine, as I said in my introduction, discussed it as well.
Maybe one of the few things that Richard Nixon and Martin Luther King Jr. agreed on, in fact.
Let me read a couple more comments before I go to your calls, more of your calls. Here's Warren, who says a $14,000 annual basic income for all adults and half of that for children would require a modest increase in taxes to a level similar to that in Germany and other northern European countries. Those countries have a higher average quality of life than we do and very sustainable economies. They weathered the Great Recession much better than us, for example. Raising the revenue will not hurt our economy, but help it. Think of all those people spending all that extra money and how much that will boost the economy. It's beginning to sound a little bit like Bernie Sanders' way of seeing economic move forward. Mike writes, on the other hand, a lot of that money would be spent on booze and drugs. I don't want my tax money to go to that. And there you have kind of a lot of the two polarized sides of this argument. Let me go to another caller, though. Ann, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Having a slight of the family from Switzerland and growing up here, I have to comment on the implementation of this if it happens. The Swiss have a much stronger social contract, and consumer problems, for example, are just much less common, and I don't think it's just because of laws. And here, so you give people extra funds, that has to go hand in hand with stronger consumer protections, because I can easily see insurance companies thinking of that money as theirs, you know. So, you know, I don't think, we would have to make a much stronger set of public investments and, you know, like the Swiss have, you know, free high-quality health care, free higher education, and so forth. I just don't think you can do that. I think it would be a failed experiment in the wrong context, and that would be a shame if it could work in a better context.
Okay. Anne, I thank you for the call. Actually, Judy Campbell is calling my attention that a caller was just saying, can't we rejigger inequality by fixing the tax system? And, of course, that's high on everybody's sort of pipe dream wish list in many respects. But let me go to more of your calls here. Let me get Willie on here from Vallejo. Willie, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to revisit this notion that, on the one hand, it's possible that, you know, as someone just said, injecting all this money into the economy could actually stimulate consumer spending and growth. And on the other hand, to what degree, the question is, what degree would that all of that extra money fuel inflationary cycle? I don't understand those dynamics.
Yeah, Mike Tanner, let me go to you here.
Well, it all depends. You have to look at both sides of the equation in terms of economic stimulus. Yes, individuals who are getting money they did not otherwise receive
would help stimulate the economy. On the other hand, if you give them that money by taking the money out of other people's hands who would have spent it, you decrease economic growth on that side of the equation. So in many cases, it's often a wash. It's what Frederick Bastiat talked about in The Seen and the Unseen, that if you take money from the French farmer and use it to build a road, the people building the road are all happy because they're getting money from the state. On the other hand, the farmer can't hire workers for his field anymore, and so those workers now go unemployed and the farmer's field, crops wither. So you've got to look at both sides of the equation as far as taxes and distribution go.
And again, Mike Tanner is a senior fellow with the Cato Institute and heads research on poverty, social welfare, and health care policy. And let me thank Willie from Vallejo and go to a tweet here from Jay who says, why does everyone assume that humans' default setting is to sit on our butts? Universal basic income might unleash artistic and entrepreneurial waves. I'm getting heads nodding and smiles from my two guests here in the studio. But let me go to more of your calls, and let's go to Aaron next. Aaron, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah. So I had a question that if this money is being raised by taxes, and if there is a slight if workers are incentivized to work, and then, so even if it's not just like, oh, I don't want to go to work, but if it's like, okay, I don't need to do my third job now, my second job now, there's a loss of revenue from that. And also, if in the future we're looking at the fact that workers are going to be losing their jobs anyway to software and robots doing the job, where does the money come from once those sources of revenue dry up?
Natalie Foster, you want to weigh in here? I mean, it's an interesting thought. You start losing work and disincentivizing. We don't know that that's going to happen. But if you do, you have more of a problem with revenue, as the caller points out.
Sure. I think there's a number of ways you could raise revenue. One idea floated is a carbon tax. So it's almost the opposite of what they've done in Alaska based on extraction. Why don't we tax what polluters currently put into the air that we commonly own, and then put that money into a trust and hand out the dividends around the country. We already have an experimental version of this in Alaska. So that's just, I think, one idea of what it could look like. But to the earlier conversation about, the question of defaulting, why do we have such a bad understanding of the human sort of who humans are. I just want to point to one of the studies done in Canada, in Manitoba. It ran for 4 years and people got a minimum income and they saw a slight decrease in people leaving the workforce. But when you dig a little closer, it was primarily people who went back to school or people who decided to stay home with their families. And so there's something there that I think is important to look beyond the numbers and just remind ourselves, actually, this money would free people up to do the kinds of things that they would want to do in life. And it might be an artistic pursuit. It might be starting a business. It might simply be, taking care of an elderly loved one.
Matthew, you wanted to put something in here?
Yeah, I would just add to Natalie's first point that I think it is possible we could see dramatic growth from doing something like this as well. I mean, if we think about people like Larry Page, Sergey Brin, Steve Jobs, when they were first starting out with their companies, and even before so, they were coming from lower middle class backgrounds, and it just happened to be the case that they had the resources where they could comfortably explore what they were interested in and pursue their educations. And these are people that went on to fundamentally transform our economy and how the world works now. And if there are more people that aren't having to just figure out how to make ends meet at the most minimal level and are free to pursue their passions and interests, we could absolutely see these hyper magnitude type people emerge and companies emerge that would really transform the conversation.
More robots, but more special human beings, too, as well. Huh?
Perhaps.
Here's a comment from a listener named Roger who raises another, perhaps, red flag in all this. He says, while I'm in support of basic income for all, it's important to consider the impact on wages in the corporate world. It would be very easy for corporations to justify lowering wages, benefits, etc., saying that workers already get enough income. My concern is that this could easily become a new form of corporate welfare to justify low wages, no benefits, etc. Just consider the number of companies who used Obamacare programs to decrease medical benefits.
Well, I'd say consider the opposite, too. If I know I'm going to receive income, I am much freer to walk off a job that I don't love. So companies will have to work a little harder to keep me there and maybe even have to, raise wages or offer more incentive to keep me there.
Because you know what I realize here? When one listener says, why do we always assume the worst of people sitting on their butts? Another listener says, we assume the worst for the corporations and what they would do. But let me get to more callers here. And we've got a caller up in Vallejo, Nick, who wants to talk about Cuba. Nick, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for a great show. And I was just in Cuba on a tech conference with a bunch of government and private sector people. And one of the things that we found out while we were there is because it's a communist country, and I hate to use that word and associate it with the program because I don't believe it's true, but they do have universal basic income. It's a little different than what you're trying to implement because they also provide basic housing, food, and education. And I just thought I'd throw it there.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. But the poverty there is wretched. I'm speaking from my own firsthand experience. And, you know, you've got this crazy system where a neurosurgeon makes less than somebody who's waiting on your table. I mean, that's the reality of Cuba economics, I'm afraid. It may be changing, but that's the way it is now. Anybody want to comment on Cuba? Mike Tanner, you?
I mean, basically, I think you described it pretty well. I don't think I would describe that as an economic system that's working.
There's a listener named Boone who writes, I actually work at a robotics lab. From the stuff I see every day, it's coming. I have two discussion questions. If it's true that we need people to be more productive before robots could pick up the slack, how about a universal basic college education? It currently seems like a much more palpable idea. And two, last I checked, GDP per capita in the United States was $60,000. That's enough to support everyone. However, the argument is that rich people and big business will flee to other countries so we can never distribute that wealth. How can we get the United States to have a fairer share of that wealth?
These are exactly the questions that we as a nation should be asking.
Well, we've got them out there. let me get Rick on. And Rick is calling from Oakland. Rick, you're on.
Well, hi, Michael. I have a comment based on a trip I took to Germany recently, and that is that in Germany, and now they do not have a basic income. We're not talking about exactly the same thing here, but they have a very solid welfare program, and it's easy for people to get on it, and it's led to a tremendous decrease in the crime rate. Walking through Berlin at night, nobody feels any fear. You don't feel the street crime. You don't feel the desperation among the poor. And so I think that a basic income also lowers the expenditures on prison and crime, and that needs to be factored in. Take my comments off the air.
Thank All right. You. That would be a fascinating thing to follow up on in your Oakland study, Matthew.
It totally is something we expect to follow up on.
And it's adjacent to other studies being done by there's a sheriff in California who's experimenting with giving people money to stay out of jail, essentially, or gun buyback programs. And in what people are using that money for is to live life. And you see a huge decrease in crime and poverty. So there are adjacent studies that I think are interesting to look at.
And we'll bring in another caller. Charles, that's you. Thank you for waiting. You're on.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I think it's very important that we suspend our prejudice of poor people when we have these discussions and stop looking at poor people as if they want to be poor because they're lazy or because they're just not motivated to work, but look at them as people in situations and that we're just talking about providing a basic income where you just barely meet the needs of the people, not giving people a abundance of wealth where they just sit around and do anything. That's not even part of the conversation, but most callers are calling in with that as in their tone of their statement.
Yeah, good point. We thank you for it, Charles. And let me go to a comment from Florian, who writes, hello. I am originally from Germany and would be interested to hear this topic discussed in the context of the current refugee crisis. To me, it sounds like that only the rich, i.e. first world countries, would be able to afford such a system, which would make them even more attractive for migration, as we currently see happening in Europe. Is this concept also feasible in less developed countries? We've got kind of a two-pronged question there, and I don't know. You want to weigh in first here, Mike Tanner?
Well, it actually is in existence in a number of less developed countries. Latin America, has Brazil and Mexico, have some experience with this. And it is being implemented, although primarily on private lines, in Africa. The Give Directly, which was mentioned earlier, is operating a number of programs in Kenya, Uganda, and Rwanda that take this concept and apply it. So I do think you're seeing some third world or some developing nations applications of this program.
But the other part of the question, Mike, and let me go to you on this also, you know, we hear all the argument often more from the right and from the nativists and so forth that there's so much of a magnet in this country for people who are poor, especially from, say, Central American countries, but also from the Middle East and so forth, because you hear the argument they go on the welfare system. And when we're talking about a guaranteed income, that would be more of a magnet, wouldn't it?
Well, we actually know that people who are immigrants, both documented and undocumented, use what social welfare programs in the United States at a lower rate than do native-born Americans. So it's not that they're coming here for welfare. Most of them come here to work. On the other hand, you also certainly can put in limits in terms of citizenship or things of that nature in terms of whether or not you get this program. The Swiss, for example, with their referendum, would have applied to only to Swiss citizens, and they have very fairly strict citizenship standards.
Yeah, a lot more strict than we do. Let me get Sasha on here. Sasha, you're on. Morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. As I'm listening, I may have missed at the beginning of the episode, but I'm trying to understand the basic question about why automation itself would kind of drive a need for a UBI, and wouldn't other jobs become available that drive the automation sector to replace that? Is it a related to a level of education?
I think, if I may, Natalie Fusser, aren't you saying in all this that as we move forward technologically, there are going to be more and more jobs eliminated, even though more jobs may emerge?
Well, yes, and that's a great debate. There's one scenario where it's tech unemployment, where essentially automation is so strong that there is, you know, high unemployment because automation has taken jobs. But there's, I think, another scenario where automation comes on slowly and more jobs are created that we couldn't have seen, like an Uber, for example, a way a number of people, millions of people now are getting supplemental income. It was a job that didn't exist 5 years ago. But I think you cannot argue that the jobs that are coming online are not good jobs. They are not the good jobs with benefits and protections that built the American middle class over the last century. And so I think for that reason alone, it's worth looking at a universal basic income to see how would we supplement middle and lower incomes that have not gone up over the last 40 years.
Well, we will continue to certainly monitor the movement and see what happens in Oakland. And let me thank our guests, Matthew Kristoloff, who manages the Basic Income Project with Y Combinator over in Oakland, and Mike Tanner, senior fellow with the Cato Institute, where he heads research on poverty, social welfare, and healthcare policy, and Natalie Foster, a fellow with the Institute for the Future, which is a nonprofit research center in Palo Alto, focusing on long-term forecasting, and she's also a co-founder of Peers, an organization that supports workers in the sharing economy. Thank you all for being on Forum with us this morning. Thank you, our listeners. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.